The U.S. Supreme Court issued major decisions yesterday on immigration and deportation, copyrights in the Internet, and on campaign finance. The court's decision on campaign finance upholds the federal law that limits the money political parties may spend to help specific candidates. The ruling could provide a boost to broader campaign reform efforts that currently are pending in the House of Representatives. NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg reports.
For 15 years, the Republican Party has been fighting a federal rule that bans parties from coordinating with candidates in the spending of party money on individual campaigns. Under federal law, parties are allowed to raise much larger contributions from individual donors than candidates are. The limit for contributions to a party is $20,000, and for a candidate, $2,000. But the parties are not allowed to coordinate their spending on campaigns with a candidate. The GOP saw that as a limit on its freedom of expression and challenged the limit in court. Yesterday, however, the Republicans lost by a 5-4 vote. While the court in the past has ruled limits on spending to be unconstitutional, it has upheld limits on contributions. And in this case, the court said the limits on spending were a way to prevent the contribution limits from being evaded. Writing for the 5-member court majority, Justice David Souter said that if parties could simply funnel money to candidates via a coordinated ad campaign paid for by the party, the $2,000 limit on contributions to candidates would be meaningless. Campaign reform supporters like Senator John McCain trumpeted the decision as a sign that a proposed ban on unregulated soft money is likewise constitutional because it, too, is aimed at preventing evasion of campaign contribution limits. But Jan Barron, who represented the GOP in the Supreme Court, notes the soft money, unlike the hard money at issue in this case, is not spent in concert with the candidates.
Evasion has been used to justify certain restrictions. Whether that can justify a restriction on banning soft money to political parties remains to be seen.
Campaign reformer Fred Wertheimer, however, sees yesterday's ruling as a big boost for reformers when the McCain-Feingold bill, already passed in the Senate, gets to the House floor in 2 weeks. Indeed, until yesterday, the consensus was that the GOP would win in the Supreme Court.
Our opponents were counting on this decision to basically argue that you can't constitutionally ban soft money, and also to basically try to turn the politics in the House. So this decision has enormous significance in constitutional terms, but it has equally enormous significance in terms of a legislative battle that's going to take place in a couple of weeks.
Dissenting from the campaign finance ruling were Justices Thomas, Scalia, Kennedy, and Chief Justice Rehnquist. Three of the dissenters said they viewed almost all the campaign finance limits as unconstitutional. Writing for them, Clarence Thomas said, "I remain baffled that this court has extended the most generous First Amendment safeguards to filing lawsuits, wearing profane jackets, and exhibiting drive-in movies with nudity, but has offered only tepid protection to the core speech that our founders sought to defend." The court's next major ruling was on immigration law and whether legal immigrants who once pleaded guilty to a crime could be automatically deported. The case was brought by Enrico St. Cyr, who came to the U.S. from Haiti in 1986. 10 years later, he pleaded guilty to a drug charge, but his lawyer told him he could ask the Attorney General for a waiver of deportation, and at the time, more than half the people who asked for such waivers were granted them. Indeed, from 1989 to 1996 alone, some 10,000 such waivers were granted. In 1996, however, Congress, worried about long delays in the deportation process, amended the immigration law to mandate deportation of anyone convicted of a long list of crimes that were deemed to be serious. The Immigration and Naturalization Service said that law meant deportation was automatic, and no one could have his case reviewed by a court. So people like Enrico St. Cyr, who'd pleaded guilty believing they could stay in the U.S. after paying for their crime, were now ordered deported with no recourse to the courts. There were thousands of these cases, some with very sympathetic facts. Take the case of Charlie Jaramillo, who came to the U.S. with his parents from Colombia when he was an infant. His parents became citizens, and he thought he was a citizen too, at least until he was in his early 30s. When he found out he wasn't, then he applied for naturalization. Instead, he was arrested by the INS.
I cried. I died. And I'm looking at my father, and my poor father is hysterical.
Charlie Jaramillo considered himself an American. He was married to an American, had two American children, he had no memory of Colombia and didn't even read Spanish. But he was ordered deported because 7 years earlier, he'd bought $40 worth of cocaine for a friend. The judge sentenced him to 6 months of home monitoring and 5 years of probation, and Jaramillo learned his lesson. He worked hard, opened a small business, and when he was taken by the INS for deportation, even the policeman who arrested him on the cocaine charge spoke up for him. But it was to no avail because the law was mandatory, or so said the INS. Yesterday, however, the U.S. Supreme Court said that to view the 1996 law as the INS did might render it unconstitutional. Writing for the 5-member court majority, Justice John Paul Stevens said immigrants like the plaintiff in this case, St. Cyr, had pleaded guilty in the expectation that they could obtain a waiver to stay in the country, and Congress could not change that retroactively. Similarly, an immigrant like Jaramillo could not automatically be deported. Even as to cases that occurred after the law was changed, where no waiver was available, the court said, immigrants have a right to judicial review of their cases before they're deported. Lucas Gudentag, director of the ACLU Immigrants' Rights Project, hailed the decision as a major victory for due process of law.
The court's decision is a ringing endorsement of the principle that immigrants are entitled to go to court and to get a judicial determination of the legality of their deportation order.
Dissenting from yesterday's ruling were Justices Scalia, Thomas O'Connor, and Chief Justice Rehnquist. Writing for them in acid tones, Scalia lambasted the majority, saying, quote, "The court has created a version of the immigration law that is not only unrecognizable to its framers or to anyone who can read, but gives the statutory scheme precisely the opposite of its intended effect, affording criminal aliens more opportunities for delay." Finally, yesterday, the Supreme Court issued a major copyright decision for the information age. The court, by a 7-2 vote, ruled that freelance writers have the right to be paid separately for their work when it's reproduced as part of a massive database online. The case was brought by freelance writers against the New York Times, Newsday, and Time magazine, but it applies to virtually all publishers who use freelance material. After the lawsuit was brought in the early 1990s, the publishers changed their practices and, when commissioning freelance articles, got authors, sometimes for a small fee, to agree to have their work reproduced in databases. That, however, left more than a decade's worth of material for which the publishers had not obtained that permission, and they claimed that under the federal copyright law, they didn't have to because an article online is the same as an article, for example, in a magazine or a newspaper. But in a decision written by Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the Supreme Court disagreed. The New York Times said it would immediately begin deleting some 100,000 articles from its database, mainly articles from the book review, travel, and magazine sections. George Freeman is Assistant General Counsel for the New York Times.
I think within weeks, you'll see these articles being removed.
I think that's an unfortunate scare tactic that we shouldn't really listen to.
Jonathan Tassini is the lead plaintiff in the case and president of the National Writers Union.
The task at hand now is to sit down with the publishers and to try to negotiate some reasonable settlement to this whole issue.
Although the publishers said yesterday they saw no way to negotiate with tens of thousands of freelance writers, industry lawyers said the publishers, in the end, would have to, or risk losing market share to publishers who do negotiate. The solution already being bandied about is to ask all freelancers who wish to negotiate to contact the publishers on a yet-to-be-created website. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.